I believe that the feelings we get from great art and from religion are closely related. In fact, I believe they may be the very same feelings. We all know that music can provide us moments of transcendence. If I weren't technologically challenged, I'd have rigged my BlackBerry to play the slow movement from Mozart's clarinet concerto. I'll give you a moment to imagine that. Poetry can be transcended in a slightly different way. Somehow the combination of sound, rhythm, and explicit meaning can take us right out of ourselves. This morning I'll read a handful of poems, taking us on a brief spiritual quest from expressions of despair to expressions of spiritual enlightenment and joy. I'll start with a poet many of you may know, Sylvia Plath, who both in her poetry and her life has become something of a byword for existential despair. The sadness of her life has had a bad effect on the way people read her poetry. Some critics essentially dismiss her because she suffered from depression and committed suicide, tragically enough, at the age of 30. But she was a great poet, the greatest mid-20th century American poet, and despite what some critics have written, her poems are not the emotional outpourings of a damaged psyche. They're beautifully crafted, remarkably intelligent testimonials to a great talent. Daddy might be her most famous poem. So here's Daddy by Sylvia Plath. You do not do, you do not do any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or achew. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time, marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one gray toe big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset. I used to pray to recover you, ach du, in the German tongue in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common. My Polack friend says there are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It stuck in a barbed wire snare. Ich, 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 ich. I could hardly speak. I thought every German was you, and the language obscene. An engine chuffing me off like a Jew. A Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck and my Tarek peck and my Tarek peck, I may be a bit of a Jew. I've always been scared of you, with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat mustache and your Aryan eye, bright blue, Panzerman, Panzerman, oh you. Not God, but a swastika so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist. The boot in the face, the brute, brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot, but no less a devil for that. No, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20, I tried to die and get back, back, back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw. And I said, I do. I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year. 7 years, if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard. I'm through. Well, that that got your attention, didn't it? Well, I've always sort of wanted to say the word bastard in synagogue. And now I've had my chance. And I won't do it. I promise. I won't do it again. When Plath wrote Daddy, the Holocaust was a recent memory, and Jews were the universal victim in a world in which faith and religion seemed worse than pointless. Faith and religion were implicated in the world's great evil. The daddy the speaker of the poem rejects is not just her father, not just her husband, but that universal daddy of us all, Jehovah, God the Father, who William Blake, 10 years before, had mocked with the title Nobadaddy, nobody's daddy. Plath wrote a less caustic poem directly concerned with the lack of any overarching meaning in the world called Black Burying. So this is the second Plath poem. Nobody in the lane and nothing, nothing but blackberries. Blackberries on either side, so on the right mainly, a blackberry alley going down in hooks and a sea somewhere at the end of it, heaving. Blackberries big as the ball of my thumb and dumb as eyes, ebon in the hedges, fat with blue-red juices. These they squander on my fingers. I had not asked for such a blood sisterhood. They must love me. They accommodate themselves to my milk bottle, flattening their sides. Overhead go the choughs in black cacophonous flocks, bits of burnt paper wheeling in a blown sky. Theirs is the only voice protesting, protesting. I do not think the sea will appear at all. The high green meadows are glowing as if lit from within. I come to one bush of berries so ripe it is a bush of flies, hanging their blue-green bellies and their wing panes in a Chinese screen. The honey feast of the berries has stunned them. They believe in heaven. One more hook, and the berries and the bushes end. The only thing to come now is the sea. From between two hills, a sudden wind funnels at me, flapping its phantom laundry in my face. These hills are too green and sweet to have tasted salt. I follow the sheep path between them. A last hook brings me to the hill's northern face. In the face is orange rock that looks out on nothing, nothing but a great space of white and pewter lights and a din like silversmiths beating and beating at an intractable metal. Just as in Daddy, the speaker is having some fun with us. The blackberries are treated as though they have volition. They flatten themselves against the side of her milk bottle, and they love the woman who gathers them. Nature, it seems, loves us, speaking of Avatar. But in this poem, only the flies believe in heaven, in a divine plan, or an eternal meaning. The sky, the speaker tells us, is blown in the same way someone's cover is blown. There is no heaven, the blackberries don't really love us, and the orange rock looks out on a sea that is only itself, that cares nothing for human beings, a sea composed of a material that can never be shaped by human hands or human intellect. But despite its expression of faithlessness, the melancholy beauty of the poem moves me very much, and it takes us one step up from the despair of Daddy. Thomas Hardy wrote poetry a half century before Plath, but they were kindred spirits. Hardy was a successful novelist, as you, I'm sure, all know, who wrote The Mayor of Casterbridge and Tess of the D'Urbervilles, but his work became increasingly dark. When he published Jude the Obscure in 1895, he deeply offended late Victorian sensibilities. It was reviled in the press. One reviewer called it Jude the Obscene. Hardy never wrote another novel, but that's okay because he then went on to write all of his great poetry. I'll start with Channel Firing from 1914. The setting is near the English Channel, just before World War I. The speaker and his companions in the poem are skeletons in a church cemetery and they get into a conversation with an angry Old Testament god, Hardy's version of Blake's Noba Daddy, and a close relative to the god that stands just behind the curtain in Platt's Daddy. This is Channel Firing by Thomas Hardy. That night, your great guns, unawares, shook all our coffins as we lay and broke the chancel window squares. We thought it was the judgment day and sat upright, while drearisome arose the howl of wakened hounds. The mouse let fall the altar crumb. The worms drew back into their mounds. The glebe cow drooled till God called, "No, it's gunnery practice out at sea. Just as before you went below, the world is as it used to be. All nations striving strong to make red war yet redder. Mad as hatters, they do no more for Christ's sake than you who are helpless in such matters. That this is not the judgment hour, for some of them the blessed sing, for if it were, they'd have to scour hell's floor for so much threatening. Ha! Ha! It will be warmer when I blow the trumpet, if indeed I ever do, for you are men in rest eternal sorely need." So down we lay again. "I wonder, will the world ever saner be," said one, "than when he sent us under in our indifferent century?" And many a skeleton shook his head. "Instead of preaching 40 years, my neighbor, parson, thirdly said, I wish I had stuck to pipes and beer." Again the guns disturbed the hour, roaring their readiness to avenge, as far inland as Sturton Tower and Camelot and starlit Stonehenge. More explicitly and directly than in Platt's Daddy, Hardy's Channel Firing presents us with the god of a discredited patriarchal society, the god of wars, of revenge, of punishment, and of testosterone-fueled anger. The god in this poem is quite happy to condemn us all to hell's flames and to the scouring of hell's floor. For Hardy, we create the god that we serve. As an old poetry professor of mine once joked, I think he was joking, when poets die, they appear before St. Peter with their portfolios. And Peter asks them about their love poems, their night poems, their death poems, their religious poems, their beach and water poems. But the poem that determines their fate is their bird poem. Hardy wrote The Darkling Thrush right at the turn of the 19th century, and this is Hardy's bird poem, The Darkling Thrush. "I leant upon a coppice gate when frost was specter gray, and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled bine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. The land's sharp features seemed to be the century's corpse outlent, his crypt, the cloudy canopy, the wind, his death lament. The ancient pulse of germ and birth was shrunken hard and dry, and every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I. At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the growing gloom. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar or nigh around, that I could think there trembled through his happy goodnight air some blessed hope whereof he knew and I was unaware." The speaker of the poem is melancholy, certainly, and he seems to have no hope for the world, no hope in the century that's about to unfold. While he's in this despairing mood, he hears an old, disheveled thrush singing happily in the darkening cold, and this gives him a suggestion of hope, of redemption. Nature has been inspiring us in just this way for a very long time. Sing cuckoo, right? I had to study Old English in graduate school, but I still couldn't have understood that poem without the translation. And honestly, the deer's fart was something that I didn't know about. You know, you learn something new every Sunday morning. Nature's been inspiring us in this way for a very long time, and the poets of the British Romantic period are famous for the many ways they celebrated that inspiration. I'll remind you of just one, my favorite. If the quality of a poet's bird poem determines the poet's place in heaven, then we know John Keats found a happy perch in paradise. Here's Ode to a Nightingale. For the young people here, there are a few, I think, who haven't seen the poem, imagine that the poet is speaking directly to the nightingale, and listen for the moment of transcendence in the middle of the poem when the speaker joins the nightingale in the garden. Ode to a Nightingale, which is somewhere. Okay. My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past, and Lutherwort's had sunk. 'Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thine happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees, in some melodious plot of beechen green and shadows numberless, singest of summer in full-throated ease. Oh, for a draught of vintage that hath been cooled a long age in the deep delved earth, tasting of flora and the country green, dance and Provençal song and sunburnt mirth. Oh, for a beaker full of the warm south, full of the true, the blushful Hippocrene, with beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple stained mouth, that I might drink and leave the world unseen, and with thee fade away into the forest dim. Fade far away and dissolve and quite forget what thou among the leaves hast never known, the weariness, the fever, and the fret, here where men sit and hear each other groan, where palsy shakes a few sad last gray hairs, where youth grows pale and specter thin and dies, where but to think is to be full of sorrow and leaden-eyed despairs, where beauty cannot keep her lustrous eyes, or new love pine at them beyond tomorrow. Away, away, for I will fly with thee, not charioted by Bacchus and his pards, but on the viewless wings of poesy, though the dull brain perplexes and retards. Already with thee, tender is the night, and haply the queen moon is on her throne, clustered around by all her starry fays. But here there is no light save what from heaven is with the breezes blown through verdurous glooms and winding mossy ways. I cannot see what flowers are at my feet, nor what soft incense hangs upon the boughs, but in embalmed darkness guess each sweet wherewith the seasonal month endows the grass, the thicket, and the fruit tree wild, white hawthorn and the pastoral eglantine, fast fading violets covered up in leaves, and mid-May's eldest child, the coming musk-rose, full of dewy wine, the murmurous haunt of flies on summer eves. Darkling, I listen, and for many a time I've been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many a mused rhyme, to take into the air my quiet breath. Now more than ever seems it rich to die, to cease upon the midnight with no pain, while thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Still wouldst thou sing, and I have ears in vain, to thy high requiem become a sod. Thou wast not born for death, immortal bird. No hungry generations tread thee down. The voice I hear this passing night was heard in ancient days by emperor and clown. Perhaps the self-same song that found a path through the sad heart of Ruth when, sick for home, she stood in tears amid the alien corn. The same that oft-times hath charmed magic casements opening on the foam of perilous seas in fairylands forlorn. Forlorn. The very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self. Adieu, the fancy cannot cheat so well as she is famed to do, deceiving elf. Adieu, adieu, thy plaintive anthem fades past the near meadows, over the still stream, up the hillside, and now 'tis buried deep in the next valley glades. Was it a vision or a waking dream? Fled is that music. Do I wake or sleep? I hope you caught the moment of transcendence when the speaker joins the nightingale in the garden. This is one example of how the Romantic poets linked transcendent experiences with a deep association with nature. A number of poems deal with religious topics, of course, and many are dedicated to the god of a particular religion. I'll read just one by Gerard Manley Hopkins because it forms a bridge with Keats's Nightingale in that it celebrates God's creation of the natural world. Hopkins was a Jesuit priest who wrote poems dedicated to Christ, but he published very few of them because they were so personal and because he wasn't sure they were quite orthodox. The one I'll read is called The Windover, which is the British name of the kestrel, a small falcon. So this is Hopkins' bird poem, and it's dedicated to Christ, our Lord. The Windover. I caught this morning morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dappled dawn-drawn falcon in his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off, off, forth on swing as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend. The hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, O air, pride, plume, here buckle, and the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. No wonder of it. Sheer plod makes plow down Cillian shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear. Oh, I've left out the last. I don't know how I did that. Somehow the last line got cut, and I can't remember it, so I apologize. Well, I've got time for one last poem, which will take us back to the 20th century. Like Sylvia Plath and John Keats, Dylan Thomas died young, but he left some beautiful poems. In Fern Hill, he celebrates his aunt's farm, where he spent the best times of his childhood. I chose it because it's his greatest poem, and because it balances the melancholy reality of our mortality with the eternal beauty and wonder of the natural world. And you'll notice that it's also a bird poem, and refers to owls, nightjars, chickens, pheasants, and swallows. Beforehand, I should tell you that a dingle is a valley, and a rick is a hayrick or a haystack. This is Fern Hill by Dylan Thomas. Let's make sure I've got the whole thing here. Looks whole. Now, as I was young and easy, under the apple boughs, about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb, golden in the heydays of his eyes, and honored among wagons, I was prince of the apple towns, and once below a time, I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns about the happy yard and singing as the farm was home in the sun that is young once only. Time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means. And green and golden I was huntsman and herdsman. The calves sang to my horn. The foxes on the hills barked clear and cold. And the Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams. All the sun long it was running. It was lovely. The hay fields high as the house. The tunes from the chimneys. It was air and playing, lovely and watery and fire. Green as grass. And nightly, under the simple stars, as I rode to sleep, the owls were bearing the farm away. All the moon long I heard, blessed among stables, the nightjars flying with the ricks and the horses flashing into the dark. And then to awake, and the farm like a wanderer, white with the dew, come back, the cock on his shoulder. It was all shining. It was Adam and maiden. The sky gathered again and the sun grew round that very day. So it must have been after the birth of the simple light in the first spinning place, the spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable on to the fields of praise. And honored among foxes and pheasants by the gay house under the new-made clouds and happy as the heart was long, in the sun born over and over, I ran my heedless ways. My wishes raced through the house-high hay, and nothing I cared at my sky-blue trades that time allows in all his tuneful turning so few and such morning songs before the children, green and golden, follow him out of grace. Nothing I cared in the lamb-white days, that time would take me up to the swallow-thronged loft by the shadow of my hand, in the moon that is always rising, nor that riding to sleep I should hear him fly with the high fields and wake to the farm forever fled from the childless land. Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, so I sang in my chains like the sea. That poem always knocks me out. Thank you very much.